Anthony Shadid is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for his coverage of the war in Iraq. In fact, he's the only journalist to win a Pulitzer for reporting in Iraq. You may recall Shadid was also one of the reporters kidnapped in Libya in the early days of the uprising there. He knows the violence of war. As he told Steve Paulson, he also knows that when war ends, unintended consequences follow.
You've spent a lot of time in Iraq over the last 10 years, and there's one particular town you've been back to a number of times since the U.S. invasion in 2003. How did you stumble upon this town?
You know, this town was, it's a nondescript town. You wouldn't find it on any maps, really. It's called Dhuluiya. It's on the banks of the Tigris River. I had gone there for the first time, I think, back in May of 2003 to report on what was then the American military's biggest response to the insurgency. It was an operation called Peninsula Strike. It attracted some attention at the time, although it's really a footnote to the war at this point. But that was what brought me there in the first place.
Why was that place of interest?
You know, I'm always interested in the aftermath of the story. I think there's the event and then there's the aftermath. And as a journalist, I always find the aftermath much more interesting. So I had gone to this town a few days after the operation had come to an end. And really, I just kind of stumbled on what turned out to be condolences. A tent had been set up to receive mourners who were paying their condolences for a 15-year-old boy who had been killed. And right then, you got the feeling that something bigger was afoot. I started to talk to people and you realize that not only was this boy killed, but 2 other people have been killed.
Killed how?
They were killed by the American military during this Operation Peninsula Strike. And as the conversations unfolded, you realize that there was a lot of anger directed not only at the Americans, but also at an informer that the Americans had used, a man named Sabah. And there was, a demand for vengeance in some respects. And they couldn't do anything about the American soldiers. They were long gone at that point. But they could do something about this informer named Sabah.
Everyone knew this man had informed for the United States.
You know, they recognized him pretty quickly. He was seen, had a bag over his head, but they could tell from his gait as he walked past people who were laying on the ground. More distinctly, they could tell that he had lost part of his finger in an accident, and they recognized this. And then they heard his voice, too. And at one point, in fact, during the interrogations, when this informer was working with the Americans, people started shouting out, "That's Sabah, that's Sabah."
So after this man, Sabah, had been fingered, essentially, as an informant, what was the talk in the town?
Well, it was, you know, even that first day that I was in Dhuluiya at that funeral tent, the tent for condolences, people were whispering about Sabah's fate. And I remember one person telling me that he'll be ripped to pieces, but not yet. And then I don't remember the exact words of another man, but it was along the lines of, he's a dead man. What happened, though, for weeks, and I actually went back to Dhuluiya a couple times in the interim, and I remember asking people, and you know, people didn't seem to know what had happened to him. And then one day in the summer in June, I was back in Dhuluiya, and I was talking to a friend that I'd made there, and he said, yeah, he was killed, and he was killed by his father.
Wow. And it's an incredible story. Why would his father end up killing him?
You know, it was such a dramatic, you know, it's hard to overstate how dramatic the change in Dhuluiya and the rest of Iraq, for that matter, was after Saddam Hussein fell. There was a vacuum, pretty much. And into this vacuum, this lawless vacuum, came the tribal leaders, the kind of traditional leaders of the town, the clan leaders. And they had a sense, a kind of frontier notion of justice. And it was very clear there was that tribal issues had entered into this. The boy that was killed was of one tribe called Ani. The informer, Sabah, was from the Djibouti tribe. And so it quickly became a tribal vendetta. And these tribal leaders, these clan leaders, said to Sabah's father, they gave him a choice. Either he kill Sabah, either he kill his son, or they, the tribal leaders, will kill everyone in his family. And so this father was faced with a choice of, you know, does he kill his son or does he face the death of everybody he knows, everybody in his family, everyone close to him? And he made that choice, a biblical choice. And he and his other son, you know, led Sabah out early in the morning. And the way the story was told to me is the father fired, I think, 2 or 3 times, and Sabah wasn't dead. He fell to the ground but was still breathing, and the father collapsed at that point and couldn't go any further. And the other brother had to fire the fatal shot.
I can't imagine a worse thing to have to do for a father or for a brother.
You know, it was one of the most haunting, and probably is the most haunting story I ever reported. And I went back after Sabah was killed, and I went to see the father. And actually, the father sat down with me, and he said words that I haven't forgotten to this day. I think maybe the most haunting words I've ever heard as a reporter. He told me that not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. And then he paused, and I remember his eyes glistened a little bit, and he said there was no other choice.
Wow. Did anyone, I mean, as this was brewing in the town, and clearly people were talking about this, was it just kind of universal decision among all townspeople that Sabah had to be killed, that his own family had to do it? Or were there other people who said, no, this is wrong?
There was a protest that came out by a man named Mullah Natham. He was a cleric in the town. And I really didn't understand that at the point when I was reporting the story, but Mullah Natham actually became a much more important character in the town. He thought these tribal leaders were trying to cover up their own crimes, that they had worked with the Americans, that they were trying to hide what they had done. And he tried to intervene. In fact, he had set up a meeting with the father the next day, but this, as the cleric put it to me, this man named Mullah Natham, that Kalashnikov was faster than I was. And it's interesting. I reported this story back in 2003. I wrote it for the Washington Post. What happened after I wrote the story for the Washington Post, though, was I think a lot of people saw the story as an example of brutality, that this is how brutal Iraq had become in the aftermath of the invasion and the beginning of the occupation. And that really troubled me. That wasn't the intention of the story. That's not how I saw the story. The story, to me, meant something very different, and that was how this very almost forgettable intervention on the part of the U.S. military, this Operation Peninsula Strike that was quickly forgotten, like I said, it was a footnote, unleashed this chain of events, this incredible chain of events that transformed this town in the years that followed. And it was just how the smallest of interventions created the greatest of unintended consequences in the town. I remember walking with him to the cemetery, walking past the gravestone. They hadn't even, fixed the gravestone, really. And just that anger that this son felt. And there was an overwhelming sense of unrequited vengeance that, the story had not ended, that the vendetta wasn't over. I remember another villager at the time had told me a story about a Bedouin whose father was killed and 40 years had passed. And they asked this Bedouin why he hadn't had vengeance yet. And he said in Arabic that it was still too early and not yet. And I remember hearing that story when I was looking at this brother of the informer as he sat near the gravestone, the marker. And I thought that same idea, that maybe it was still too early, that he hadn't had his vengeance yet.
Were you angry as you covered these? I mean, you saw the horror that was happening, how this village was ripped up, how probably good people were turned into to villains.
I think every journalist, I think it's probably good for every journalist to have a little bit of outrage in them, things that transpire. Otherwise, it's, you lose that desire to write and to hold people accountable and to try to bring some meaning to all these things that are happening. There have been a lot of times that I've been very upset and very angry in Iraq. It's hard to convey how brutalized and how traumatized that country is. It's hard to catalog and to chronicle how many people have actually died since 2003. You don't meet anyone in Baghdad that doesn't have a friend or a relative killed. And that's kind of it's a sweeping statement, but it's depressingly accurate, And I think there is a little bit of anger of, did all this have to happen? What was this all for? And I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I don't know what the answer is until today.
And you've said that you keep going back, kind of trying to find some meaning to all this. Is there meaning to be found?
Yeah, maybe there's not. I'll tell you, one word that always struck me, the word is zahamath in Arabic. It's ambiguity. Something's ambiguous. It's unknown. We can't really figure it out. And that word has always struck me. It's always defined a lot of the experience for me, at least in Iraq, is that, all these years later, it's still ambiguous. What's next? What is going to happen? How is this going to turn out? And, there's a very linear sense of things in America, especially when it comes to Iraq. We invaded, we occupied the place, we withdrew, Iraqis are on their own. There's nothing linear about Iraq, though, and I think in a lot of ways the seminal moments in that country's history haven't even happened yet. I mean, how this is going to turn out, the events that shape that, I think still await us.
Well, and there's also a narrative that's been constructed from the U.S. perspective, and certainly for the people who supported the war, it was, the United States was seen as the liberators. We were coming in to depose an awful tyrant, and we were going to help this country on the road to democracy, and obviously things are way more complicated than that, and we became occupiers, right?
I think it's such a that's another thing. If you talk about trying to making these kind of more sweeping statements about Iraq, is how much it was dominated by this contest of narratives as occupier, as liberator, as something in between. It, the insurgents tried to make their own narrative. They did it through spectacles of bombings, of car bombings, suicide bombings, what have you. The Americans tried to do it through those images, those kind of lasting images, Saddam's statue falling down, for instance, or as recent as August when the last combat soldier supposedly withdrew. This has been a war of narratives, and those narratives, I think have been a disservice to us in some ways, of really appreciating how ambiguous, how gray Iraq really is. It's not a story of blacks and whites. It's a story of grays, and I think it's gotten in the way of us understanding what we've done and what are the consequences of our actions going to be.
But can a country talk about a war without constructing narratives?
I wonder. You know, I maybe it's not. I guess the narratives are probably inevitable in some ways. And, you know, I think it's part of the job as journalists is to try to write against those dominant narratives, especially if those narratives feel, you know, less than truthful. I guess what's more disturbing to me, though, is that, you know, I think back to Vietnam. Of course, I'm too young to have really experienced Vietnam, but there did seem to be a reckoning with Vietnam after that war was over in this country. What was it for? What did it mean? What are its consequences? I don't feel like we've had that reckoning with Iraq, and we certainly haven't had it with Afghanistan, although that war is very much still underway. Are we going to have that reckoning with Iraq? And that's a question I wonder. I wonder if we're going to ask that question of ourselves. You know, what did it mean and what was it all for? You know, what kind of lessons we're going to draw from what's happened there over the past 7 years.
Well, and we tend to focus on what has happened to American soldiers who've gone over there and sort of, you know, the trauma that they've experienced coming home. If they did, in fact, make it home, we tend not to really focus on the people in Iraq.
You know, 100,000 dead. I mean, maybe the number's fewer. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's much more. You know, 100,000 dead in Iraq would be the equivalent of, what, 1 million dead in America. I mean, it's a toll that a number will never capture. You know, only the most dramatic stories really convey what has happened to that society, what has happened to that society's fabric, how it's been ripped apart. You know, you can't emerge from that kind of carnage anytime soon. And I think we do it at some level, some moral level. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but there's some kind of moral reckoning I think we need to make with what we've left behind.
Anthony Shadid is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize twice for his coverage of the war in Iraq. He's the only journalist to win a Pulitzer Prize for Iraq war reporting. Shadid spoke with Steve Paulson.